Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio here on Paternoster Row. If you know where that is, we're in the workstation. There is an event at the workstation today. I think it's a maker's market. Mm. All the students are back now, of course, ready to start a new year. Some of them beginning for the first time. Interesting stuff, eh? Later in this hour, we'll be talking to RPG. We'll also got our guest speaker this week. It's Chris Dale. Indeed, it is Chris every fourth Saturday of the month, and he's going to be talking about baby food firms told to make products healthier or face action. He would say, here on the Life Science Radio Show, we've been talking about this for years. But there you go. Elsewhere in the news, before we get to that, I'm going to pick up on an article I read a little bit of a few weeks back about, you know, everybody's back off holiday now, schools are back, universities, everything's starting to ramp up and get more stressful and busy. And it was an article about how to try and carry on doing things that you maybe did on the holiday that actually are rather good for you. Interestingly, it's all about how to look after your brain, and it says allow yourself to get bored. One of the greatest luxuries of a holiday is unstructured time. At home, it's easy to reach for your phone the moment there's a pause. Resist that impulse. Instead, let your attention drift as you would on a sun lounger. Gaze out of your window, watch the clouds, doodle even. These small, aimless moments activate the default network and lead to sudden insights and creative breakthroughs in ways we're only just beginning to understand. Even when mind wandering hinders our performance in a task, when we have our heads in the clouds for just a little too long, it still ramps up creativity overall. So a good point there. Also, keep playing games and even crosswords count. Play comes easily on holiday. Frisbee and volleyball on the beach, card games that go on for hours. But once we're home, that sense of fun often disappears from our schedules. But it's one of the most powerful ways to keep the holiday feeling alive. Play is unstructured, imaginative, open-ended and crucially off-task, exactly what your brain's default network craves. Research shows that playful activity increases neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to adapt and grow while also resetting our limited attention resources. The best part is that micro moments of play are enough, a quick puzzle or kicking a ball around with your kids. And this is another really interesting one as everybody's back to work and school and studying, etc., etc. Never check work emails at night. For many, holidays are the only time they fully disengage from work. But if you want the benefits to last, the boundaries can't vanish the moment you get home. Overwork thins the frontal cortex in the same way that aging does. It makes the brain older than it is. That's because chronic stress and long hours cause neurons to lose their branch-like structures known as dendrites, which are essential for communication between brain cells. Once dendrites are lost, they are incredibly hard to recover, leading to slower thinking, poorer judgment, and reduced emotional regulation. In time, overwork can also disrupt the balance of key brain chemicals, raising cortisol levels and increasing inflammation, all of which accelerate cognitive decline. Studies from researchers in Scandinavia have shown that once overwork sets in, it can take up to 3 years to recover. So protect the gains of your holiday by ring-fencing your evenings, turning off notifications, and resisting the urge to check your work emails at night. And those tips came from a book. It's called The Brain at Rest by Joseph Gibelli. And it's out now on the Tova book label. So brilliant stuff. And elsewhere in the science news this week, ooh, interesting. The Independent has published its annual list of the world's leading environmentalists, ranging from grassroots campaigners to high-flying financiers. It includes established names such as Dr. Jane Goodall, Greta Thunberg and Ed Miliband, as well as young campaigners such as Aisha Siddiqua, the 26-year-old climate advisor to the United Nations Secretary General.
Yes, hundreds of people were able to swim in the Chicago River last weekend for the first time in nearly a century after years of investment in water infrastructure. The river used to have a reputation for being riddled with waste and pollution, so much so that one section was called Bubbly Creek due to the methane emerging from rotting animals.
No, not good at all. Another interesting one. According to the Sunday Times Good University Guide, which was published last weekend, applications to agricultural land management courses are on the up. The Royal Agricultural University has seen a 14% increase in applications for its two-year foundation degree, and the Harper Adams University in Shropshire has reported increased interest from a broader range of students, and they believe that's sparked by programs such as Clarkson's Farm. The good news, this is good news for lots of reasons, because earlier this year the government released data that said the number of farms fell by almost 23% between 2005 and 2023, whilst in July this year farmers on just 33% of holdings felt positive about their future in farming.
Elsewhere in the news, a farm has been given permission to build a small plant to produce renewable electricity from animal waste. Dobcross Hall in Gateskill, near Dalston in Cumbria, has received planning permission from Cumberland Council to install the micro-scale anaerobic digester on its site. The digester will use slurry from the farm's dairy herd to create electricity as well as fertiliser. The council supported development and said it would not have a detrimental impact upon the living conditions of nearby residents, highways or biodiversity.
And drivers who persistently refuse to pay ULEZ fines in London, that's the ultra-low emission zone fines in London, could be made bankrupt. Ooh. Transport for London, or TfL for short, said 94% of ultra-low emission zone debt is owed by drivers with at least 4 penalty charge notices outstanding, and that efforts to deliver stronger enforcement could, in extreme cases, involve bankruptcy proceedings.
Eco-conscious designers were on full display at London Fashion Week, with clothing made from ornamental shrubs and recycled milk cartons to show fashion students that they can recycle virtually anything. one particular striking red gown, as worn by Prue Leaf, was made from an
old RAF
parachute.
I thought it was brilliant. I'm not sure they came in red, but there you go. Interesting. And finally, we had to save this for last for obvious reasons. This weekend, the first public rail journey is being recreated 2 centuries after George Stephenson's locomotion number one first made the trip. A working replica of the steam locomotive will retrace the birth of our modern railway today, the 27th of September 2025, 200 years after the iconic event in 1825. The replica train will take invited guests along the original Stockton and Darlington line from yesterday, which was the 26th of September, until tomorrow, the 28th of September. And all day today, we're actually from 7:30 this morning. Radio 3 have been broadcasting on a train all the way from, is it Inverness?
Inverness.
And it's the longest direct train journey in the country. And it ends up in King's Cross, but it goes to Edinburgh and various other places. You've got Petroc Trelawney. We've been listening to it. It's absolutely fantastic what he's doing. I'm sure everybody will want to catch this train. What's it called? The Highland... Come on, Paul.
Herald or something.
No, we'll have to think about that. But anyway, it's a lovely piece of music, and why not? Technology, that should have been a track called "And the Train Left the Station, Trailing Sparks and Stars" by Reeves Gabrels and Bill Nelson. But unfortunately, he didn't want to play. But
then track number two didn't want to play.
We played that because it's the anniversary of the first public rail journey 200 years ago. But never mind, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have our PG on the line.
We gotta live on science.
Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Yes, on this rather sunny September morning.
It is, and isn't technology fun?
Isn't technology marvellous when it works and when it doesn't? What a shame, eh? Never mind. Your track's on the hard drive. There's no fear of that skipping.
Good stuff.
So what's caught your eye then in the science news this week?
Well, on the local news front, a few weeks ago I mentioned that Sheffield was going to host one of the first AI conferences in the UK. And the news this week from the University of Sheffield is that some of their researchers have won the UK's first national prize for AI, and it's an award recognising the strength and impact of the UK's AI research, and it's been awarded to academics from the University of Sheffield.
Wow, great.
So, they've been recognised for their research in driving the responsible use and development of artificial intelligence. Their research has helped inform responsible AI policies for major organisations across the country, such as the British Library and Sheffield City Council.
Oh.
Yeah, so Sheffield researchers were honoured at the UK's first national AI conference to champion the strength and impact of the research in the UK. So it's the first national conference, as I said, and it was awarded to the University Centre for Machine Intelligence from their research, which is, say, helping to drive the AI futures at places like British Library and Sheffield Council. They're led by Dr. Dennis Newman Griffiths, Dr. Susan Oman, and they've been working with the organisations to shape the best practice using artificial intelligence in their sectors. They looked across the sort of skill ranges with a team of Dr. Kate Milner, Dr. Andrew Cox, Professor Lawrence Brooks, Dr. Hadley Beresford from the University School of Information, Journalism and Communication, and Professor Chris Bennett from the School of History, Philosophy and Digital Humanities, Dr. Gavin Boyce from the University's Library, and two postdoctoral researchers, Dr. Hannah Guy and Dr. Nikita Bala. So Sheffield getting itself involved right up the beginning, laying the ground rules for good practical use of AI in places like, I say, British Library. They're having a follow-up workshop with Sheffield City Council, which is, again, one of the nominated lead centres. And also sort of worked on some multi-award-winning artists called Blast Theory, who developed an interactive artwork to represent and engage people with the responsible AI use, which they call the Constant Washing Machine, which captures the everyday social nature of the decisions and effect responsible AI in practice, and the slipperiness of its language.
Oh, I like it. Good old Sheffield, that's what I say. Yay!
Yeah, thanks. Great to hear that they're at the sharp end of artificial intelligence. So it's very good. I think if I can go and find where I was. What I want to talk about is something from a practical sort of look at history. And I think it all started in northern France, and they were building a new hotel, a new hospital in northern France. And as they were digging up the foundations and things, they unearthed a mass grave, unfortunately, of 100 people. And the people who were doing the work knew what they could do to call, because in northern France, a lot of these graves end up being war graves. And there are sort of soldiers from the First World War that are found in a lot of these sort of graves. So there's a special department that works on... fiddling away here, trying to get to...
Have you lost it? Can you blame the cat?
No, it's not a cat today. It's me, I think. But, unfortunately, I've been scrolling through a lot of stuff this morning, so getting back to where
I'm... You can't find where you should be reading from. This is what happens on live radio.
Anyway, so it's... here we go. So, this is about solving a 100-year-old mystery of two missing Scottish soldiers.
Oh!
And from the remains that were found on this site in northern France, they had unearthed the remains, so they collected a lot of artifacts. Because of the nature of what's involved, they were on site within hours to go and start collecting the materials that were there. So Stephen Nagy, who's the head of the recovery unit from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, arrived within hours and started a painstaking investigation, which started to run through. So the team of specialist archaeologists who are on standby 24/7 confirmed that the soldiers' bodies had been found. They removed the remains and any artifacts and extract as much information as they can. This building site was in a place called Lens, L-E-N-S, which was on had been on the Western Front during the First World War, and it was the scene of one of the biggest battles in the First World War, the Battle of Loos, L-O-O-S. And the Commission's headquarters, they've got an array of objects like belt buckles, parts of boots, shoulder badges, buttons, and regimental insignia. So they look into all of those things to try and start to put a name to the remains of these soldiers, so that families and people can be told about what they're doing. Searching through these remains, they actually found the shoulder badges from soldiers who had fought in two Scottish regiments, the Gordon Highlanders and Cameron Highlanders. And to establish who they were is a bit of a detective archaeological sort of endeavour. So the nondescript office block at one part of Imjin Barracks in Gloucester is the home to the Ministry of Defence unit called the Joint Casualty and Compassionate Centre, the JCCC. And they're tasked with identifying the remains of British troops who were killed in the historical campaigns. And it's not widely known about the kind of work they do. I mean, we see a lot about the use of science for crime and areas like that. But this is a case that was worked on by Nicola Nash, who's been a caseworker at JCC for 10 years. And she started to look through the list of Cameron Highlander soldiers who were still missing from the Battle of Loos. And she used things like the 1911 census to narrow down the search for individual names. But in that process, she also notices a bit of an unusual detail, because one of the men's bodies remains had been found with some tiny buttons in the pocket from Newcastle Corporation tramways.
Oh, wow.
So they said that was quite an unusual thing for a Scottish soldier. So they wondered if they could actually make steps forward by using that. So among the names from the census, she'd found a tobacconist assistant called Gordon McPherson. And the key information that they got is that James, his father, and he were working as a storekeeper at Newcastle Corporation Tramways.
Oh.
So the team needed to be certain that they were the remains of Gordon McPherson, which meant trying to track down relatives who were willing to carry a DNA test. So, again, lots of application of science.
Well, yeah, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so when they got the name of someone who was probably alive, then they'd start to Google them and try and find them and locate them on things like Facebook and LinkedIn. And that search led to two brothers, Andrew and Alistair McPherson, from Whitley Bay in North Tyneside, who said that when they were boys, they'd been fascinated by what they called the black box, which is their family heirlooms passed down through the generations. So when visiting their grandparents, they'd ask for the box to be brought out so they could rummage through the stuff that was there. And they said inside was a musket ball from the Boer War, medals, citations and letters, some of which were very difficult to read now. But both of them were in their 60s at the time. And they said that the heart-wrenching letters written by their great-grandmother searching for her lost son will bring tears to their eyes when they were searching through this box. So, regimental war diaries had shown that their great-uncle, Gordon McPherson, had been killed on the first day of the Battle of Loos, but his body had never been found. And then last year, Alistair received a letter out of the blue from the Ministry of Defence saying that remains had been found in France that could belong to his relative. And from that letter that Nicola Nash sent to them, they said they believed the body could be Gordon's because of these buttons. And so his great-grandfather was the chief inspector on Newcastle Tramway, so they assumed that he'd given Gordon the buttons for luck.
Yeah.
And it was lucky because it helped identify his remains. So they gave DNA, and that was confirmed as a positive match.
Wow.
To the remains. So the investigation established they'd found Gordon McPherson, who was 23 and a Lance Corporal in the 7th Battalion of the Cameron Highlanders. And he lived and worked in Edinburgh as a tobacconist before the war. Gordon and his brothers, Jim and Charles, served in the army during World War One. Charles was a bugler, just 14 years of age. Their father, James McPherson, regimental sergeant major of the Northumberland Fusiliers. So they were said that there were lots of tears when they confirmed that Gordon's remains had been traced. The story of him has always been present in the family's sort of heirlooms. And they said, it's what an absolute miracle that they found
Yeah, him. After all that time.
Yeah, wow. And saying that using war records, Nicola Nash discovered that 14 officers from the regiment had been in that area. And again, tracing families and DNA matches, they eventually found a match for the other shoulder badge. And that was James Alan Grant, who was a 20-year-old lieutenant. And it turned out that his great-nephew lived just three doors away from a member of the war detectives team.
Wow.
So, the Allen family from Scotland were brought up in Stroud in Gloucestershire, and Nicholas Allen runs a cafe there for more than 20 years. And he and his family grew up knowing all about one of their relatives in the Great War. And he'd been at work when he got a call from Nicola Nash again, telling him that his DNA sample was a match and the remains found in France were those of his great-uncle.
Wow.
And as most of us, he said, it stopped him in his tracks and the hairs on the back of his neck went up. And it's just amazing that this has come out of the blue after more than 100 years.
Yeah. The striking thing for me, Paul, is how young they were when they died, 23 and 20.
Well, it is, and I think, you know, a lot of the people, there were so many people involved that, we have the sort of tomb of the forgotten soldier and things like that, where they try and cover all those people who went missing. So it's a great sort of detective story. It's a great bit of science.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, I think just linking to the AI, they're doing a job which AI could possibly help with.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
because it's really sort of combing through those records, putting clues together, and coming up with
and narrowing it down, because it could be quite a massive task, actually.
Yeah, it is, and I think anyway, they were arranged then for these two people to be put to rest in the Lewes British Cemetery.
Wow.
Along with their comrades. And Alistair said, we're going to need a bigger black box now to put this story into.
Fantastic. So, what a story, eh?
Yeah. And the last 10 years, the recovery unit have found and buried the remains of more than 300 British soldiers from the First World War.
Wow. Amazing. Where did you read about that, Paul?
It's the BBC.
Is it?
Yeah, I sort of come across the story, and just to sort of look at that and apply science throughout that process.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, skilled people, great. And I'll say that's possibly an area where, because we talked about artificial intelligence, that they could apply some artificial intelligence when they're collating from things like the census. If you're looking for, in my family, we had someone who's commemorated in a local sort of graveyard, Jonathan, and he was lost in the First World War.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of interesting to look back and see.
And think that actually there's always a chance you might find them.
Yeah, well, he was a good horseman and went out there again. So the number of horses that were involved in the First World War, and sadly the numbers that they put down in France rather than returning them back to the UK were massive. So if you go and watch something like War Horse, you get a feeling for the life of the animals that were taken out.
Yeah, as well as the humans. But, brilliant.
Wow. Yeah, but I thought just that sort of application, it makes a bit of a change to see something that's a concrete sort of development from the application of science.
Indeed, and you chose a very interesting track, Paul, Living in the Past by Jethro Tull, and it's a great track as well.
I think it is, and I think it maybe just gives you a bit of a flavour of these people.
Brilliant, Paul. We shall speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye bye.
Look forward to it. Cheers.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Living in the past, Jethro Tull, that was our PG's choice, talking about missing soldiers and science, all good stuff. You listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12, we should have our Chris Dale on the line. All being well. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, how's everybody?
Very well. You're sounding loud and clear, I hope.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you really well. Just to say we've got a special listener listening today.
Have you indeed?
Who's recovering from an operation on his shoulder. Love to my son, Tom.
Could that be Tom? He was looking in pretty good shape. The photograph you sent, actually, of him, even though he's had major surgery.
Yeah, well, he's listening. So,
good morning. Good morning, Tom.
Right, yes. So I'm here today to talk about baby food. And last month, baby food manufacturers have been told that they must cut levels of salt and sugar in their products and stop promoting snacks for babies under the age of one, the government has said. They're bringing in new guidance that would also restrict the use of marketing claims that suggest health benefits without any scientific evidence to back it up. And firms that do not make their products healthier within 18 months may face action. Now, Julie and Paul, haven't we been through this before?
About a year ago, maybe more. Firms,
yeah, and they were saying that firms may face action, so it's not actually saying they will face action at this time. But actually, this comes after 4 months after a BBC Panorama investigation, and that found that top brand baby food pouches lacked key nutrients, and parents were often misled by marketing. And again, we were talking about salt and sugar in baby food over a year ago, weren't we? So we are the leaders and Panorama followed, Julie.
Well, you are the leader, Chris. You are the leader. You chose to talk about ultra-processed foods and diet and impact on health and how actually the food manufacturers and food and drink manufacturers have a lot of power, don't they? Over
they do.
You know, they're influencers, aren't they? Really?
Absolutely. And it's part of it is because of the amount of money that they spend on advertising and things like that. So manufacturers told the BBC Panorama that they were committed to providing high quality and nutritious foods and marketing and labelling them in a responsible way. So, of course, they're committed to it. They just don't do it, as we know. And that also draws parallels with what's been happening in other countries as well, hasn't it? I mean, India, if you remember, the government were going to bring in regulation. They ended up saying that the food market could regulate itself. Do you remember?
Yeah, but obviously the food market will not regulate itself.
So, right, I'm just going to just continue because there's some bits in here that are quite frightening. So, there's been a significant growth in the baby food and drink market in recent years, and we discussed that that's also been the case in Asia as well, haven't we? Food pouches make up more than a third of this market, and there have been a rise in sales of snacks like fruit and vegetable-based straws, puffs and wafers. And according to the chief nutritionalist to the government, which is a lady called Dr. Alison Tedstone, she says companies are dressing these products up as being healthy when actually they're much like a crisp or sweet. They're putting profit before health. Now, isn't that frightening?
It is. It's like breakfast cereals, isn't it? Saying it's really healthy, but actually you look at it, it's full of sugar, salt, additives.
Absolutely. So Dr. Tedstone said, I hope an ethical business will stand back and think about the health of our children. Well, clearly you've just mentioned cereals, and they're clearly not thinking about the health of children. We keep going back to that awful thing called Crave, which is just sugar for breakfast, chocolate-flavoured sugar. But there you go. So in June, NHS advice was updated to tell parents they should not rely on baby food pouches as everyday meals, with experts believing they can cause health problems for children if used as their main source of nutrition. And again, we spoke about this 2 years ago, saying you shouldn't have too many processed food, should you? You should make your own. These new government guidelines now turn to manufacturers, telling them to improve their products and range. This has been a key demand of health campaigners, and I'd like to think we are a bit of that as well, who says it is companies that need to improve, not to put pressure on parents.
Because the you're only buying what's available, aren't you, basically?
Well, absolutely. And there was an example of a mum from Leeds, a mum of two, who said that health and nutrition is important. And she's used commercial baby foods to feed her son, Austin, who's now two. Like most parents, I take my children's health and nutrition very seriously, but for far too long, there have been misleading marketing messages about the nutritional value of baby food and its implied healthiness of some of the infant food snacks. And again, I think to myself, well, we discussed this when we were talking about alcohol. You know, Guinness is good for you. Heineken refreshes the parts of the beers. And it just seems to be okay, or people think it's okay to put misleading stuff onto food, and to do it with baby food, I think, is a very serious thing to do.
Yeah, because you're starting them young, aren't you, really?
Well, absolutely. And companies have previously been able to market products to babies as young as 4 months old, even though the government guidelines state that solid food should not be given to babies under 6 months. So again, they're trying to get in early, and we've had similar things with that, haven't we, with the alcohol market targeting younger people to try and get them to be taking products at an early age. And that sort of thing, and that's again replicated in the baby food market. There just seems to be a model that they seem to follow.
It's like Alka Pops. They're like it's glorified pop, but with alcohol in it. So it's getting you hooked on that.
So under the guidelines, sugar levels will be restricted, and this is, bear in mind, this is for babies. You've got to keep this in mind. This is for babies. Under the guidelines, sugar levels will be restricted in finger foods, snacks, desserts, and non-refrigerated yogurts. But there's going to be no maximum level of sugar permitted in fruit pouches. And this is despite fruit pouches containing more sugar in a single pouch than a one-year-old should have in a day. Companies have also been told to restrict the use of marketing claims on their products, which are not based on scientific evidence. I mean, it's outrageous, this. Experts argue that these claims often make products appear healthier than they really are, and sometimes even appear to be a better choice than homemade food. Some leading baby food pouches carry labels such as "just good stuff" or "packed with goodness," despite research finding that some of the products to be low in key nutrients and very high in sugar. Dr. Alison Tedstone, who's, I think, becoming one of my heroes now, led the team that wrote the guidelines, and she told the BBC that this is now a line in the sand. The guidelines, however, are voluntary, and the government hopes that they will be followed. So Panorama contacted the baby food manufacturing industry, and it's called British Specialist Nutrition Association. And that represents all the biggest baby food manufacturers, yeah? So they call themselves British Specialist Nutrition Association. So that suggests that they're trying to improve the nutrition. Anyway, they say, we've carried out significant improvements to recipes in recent years, including reducing sugar and increasing vegetable content, and continually review on-pack information. And they've said that they will continue to work towards the published guidelines. Baby foods can play an important role alongside homemade prepare meals and offer options for parents on the go. And again, we've had that, haven't we, from the ready meal market and from the junk food market, from your hamburgers, where they always say, no, no, you should only have these in conjunction or occasionally, don't they? But they don't market but them it, that way.
And so they're addictive. Really misleading. And it's addictive, isn't it? When you get a taste palate for that sort of ultra-processed food, it's very hard to then eat something that's not full of stuff that makes you want to carry on eating it or drinking it.
And then, so they said they will continue to work towards the published guidelines, saying baby foods... Yeah, I've already said that. Sorry, it was Heinz and Kiddylicious, which are two of the big companies, didn't even respond. And when the companies were contacted... were contacted individually, they just referred it to that BSNA statement that I just read.
Well, I think so that tells you, all you need to know then.
Everything that you need to know. And then, so again, going back to my superhero, Dr. Alison Tedstone, she said that she hopes that companies would start thinking about the future health of the children rather than profit. And she also added that families should not feel guilty for using the product. She said, this is about making changes to the food products that are available for young children, and it's about making them healthier and not about shaming parents, which I can understand, because if you're a family, very busy, you tend to rely on what you see on the supermarket shelf. And if it says it's healthy, you assume it's going to be healthy, even though it's not.
Very interesting.
Just to finish up, so the government hasn't said that they will enforce anything. At this moment, the government are still saying that it's voluntary. And I think that's really happens. But you and I and Paul and PG, we've spoken about this at length. When the food industry regulates itself, and there isn't proper regulation in, and we've discussed this time and time again on the Live Science Radio show, they don't do anything until they're forced to do it.
Indeed. It's like the sugar tax, and, you know, the government's quite loath, isn't it, to put pressure and mandate, but sometimes that's the only way to actually stop them.
And we've also discussed, and this is a really important one, that one of the leading supermarkets that makes ready meals, they've stopped adding, bad additives, and they're using more natural additives and trying to change the ingredients. And that was in response to public pressure and public not buying the old type product and looking for something healthier. So actually, if parents stop buying this stuff and demand that they will only buy it if it is healthier, that's really the only way it's going to change, because it impacts on the profit margin, doesn't it?
The trouble is, because a lot of people do rely on ready meals, and I've seen an aisle in Tesco now called Quick Meals, not ready meals, Quick Meals. But, you know, some of the cheaper ready meals or quick meals are just full of e-numbers. You know, if you've got more money to go to, perhaps, I think I know the supermarket you're referring to, but for a lot of parents, you know, they're going to go and shop and buy. You know, if you're on a tight budget and you've got to feed your kids and da-da-da, you're not necessarily going to look at what's in the packaging, or you're just going to buy it, aren't you?
Well, and in many cases, people are forced. I mean, we use that example that if you made a lemon drizzle cake at home and you bought all the ingredients and you cooked it, it would cost something in the order of £4.50 to make a lemon drizzle cake. The same lemon drizzle cake that's manufactured in a factory costs 22 pence.
Yes, because it's not full of any. It's not full of any lemons or anything. It's
well,
just
right. They use chemicals, don't they?
Lemons. It's a very interesting one, though. But also for children, very, very young children, sugar anyway is bad in your diet, but it's bad for your teeth as well. You know, it's not just bad for you as a health. So a lot of kids have got really poor dental hygiene because they're drinking drinking a lot of sugary drinks and they're eating a lot of sugary foods. And if you're starting that at 4 months old, you've just got a big problem, haven't you? Amazing.
Well, I was talking about this with my son Tom in the car, and when both my children were young, we used to cook vegetables and we used to mash them up. We never added salt. We never added butter. Or, you know, we kept them pure, and the children ate it and enjoyed it. And it was only when they sort of got a little bit older and they started mixing with other children and eating that we sort of introduced things like smiley faces, baked beans, that sort of stuff, maybe sausages. I have to admit, our family are addicted to sausages.
Including you, Chris. Yes.
Hey. Yeah,
absolutely. We did try and give them as healthy start in life that we possibly could, and we were very lucky that our children weren't picky eaters. They pretty much ate anything that we put in front of them. But if you do have a child that's a picky eater, you know, it can get very stressful to see it. So sometimes going to one of these pouches and the child will eat it because it maybe has got that
hyper-palatable taste.
Hyper-palatable food that has been researched and researched and researched and marketed and researched and refined so that they know that the babies or young children will eat it. It's, you know, it's very disappointing, but I always say, and I will say once more, a lot of our pensions and investments go into companies like Kellogg's and Kiddylicious and all that sort of thing. If those companies weren't making profit, it would impact on all of us, even though we all know that it's not good for you.
Very interesting, Chris. You'll be on Panorama next.
Oh, I hope not. I just like doing the live sound.
Yeah, it is interesting stuff. Great stuff, Chris. And we're going to play out with a track you've chosen, Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses.
All right.
Bye. Guns N' Roses there, Sweet Child of Mine, because Chris was talking about baby food firms told to make products healthier or face action. We shall see. We all come to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. The film show already and raring to come in. But before that, a little bit more about this momentous event today, 200 years. Since the Stockton and Darlington Public Railway, 1825 it was, and certainly a radical venture, but it was not entirely revolutionary. Groove tracks once helped ships on wheeled cradles move over the Isthmus of Corinth in ancient Greece, while horse-drawn trucks travelling over rails had been hauling coal from mines for decades. Similarly, Richard Trevithick had already pioneered the use of high-pressure steam to power locomotives. However, it was the genius of the railway's engineer, George Stephenson, backed by the line's main financier, the Quaker businessman Edward Pease, to combine iron tracks, flange wheels and steam power into a single system and so create the world's first railway, a 26-mile line that has been copied and repeated over the past two centuries to provide the planet with a web of more than 800,000 miles of track. Radio 3 are doing Train Tracks, a programme that's running throughout today. Fantastic stuff. Bye-bye.